I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Last month, Hurricane Florence walloped parts of North Carolina. According to the Weather Channel, it was the wettest tropical storm to ever hit the Tar Heel State. So how did the restaurant industry respond? Some helped FEMA weather the storm, while others got to work feeding people on the ground.
We just walked in and said, we know how to cook, what can we do? They said, I need you guys to just cook 150 pork loins, and we were just like, okay.
Now the attention needs to be on Florence's long-term effect on North Carolina's farming community.
The general mood of farmers is one of certainly resilience and almost feels like it's the normal course of business to just get hit by a gigantic hurricane and need to just keep on going.
So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, a co-working and event space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
Hi, everybody. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. Each week, we bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life through conversations with the most inspiring women in and around the world of food. First, let's thank our sponsors, Le Cordon Bleu. If you're daydreaming about culinary school, maybe it's time to say bonjour to Le Cordon Bleu. Learn more about the legendary culinary school's most prestigious professional qualification, Le Grand Diplôme, by visiting cordonbleu.edu. And let's thank Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs. Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs are better than cage-free. They are bull-free. Try for yourself. To get your coupon for Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs, head to vitalfarms.com/cherrybomb. Some housekeeping. Cherry Bomb University is, oh my God, next week. Can you believe it? I can't. CBU is taking place in Manhattan on October 26th, 27th, and 28th at the Food and Finance High School, a real live New York City high school. All tickets are on sale now, except the ones that sold out. Martha Stewart and Christina Tosi are getting honorary doctorates on Friday night, and we're giving a humanitarian award that evening to Jessamine Rodriguez. You can take classes with the likes of Sophia Rowe, Athena Calderon of iSwoon, Katrina Markoff from Vogue, you've all heard her on Radio Cherry Bomb. Jen Pelka, speaking of Radio Cherry Bomb, Jen did that amazing episode where she talked about raising money. Clancy Miller, who has guest hosted Radio Cherry Bomb, she will be teaching people how to write recipes, which is actually a really fun thing to learn because you just think a recipe is a recipe, but guess what? It's not. We've got Allison Roman of Dining In fame and those shortbread chocolate chip cookies. She is the Dean of Home Cooking. And she will be speaking at the Assembly on Saturday. Sunday, we've got Jenny Britton Bauer speaking at the Assembly. She's going to not just talk about ice cream, but she'll be talking about what it's like to be an entrepreneur. Saturday is the food day. Sunday is the business and entrepreneur day. So anyway, as you can tell, we've got an incredible weekend set up for you. So don't miss it. Go to cherrybomb.com to find tickets, more information, et cetera, et cetera. All right, we have a great episode for you today. I'm so excited because I had the chance to sit down with a very special member of the Bomb Squad, Molly Yeh. I know so many of you love Molly as much as I do. She's a blogger, a cookbook author, one of the sweetest people we know. She also comes up with the coolest creations around that fuse her Chinese and Jewish heritages, like her scallion pancake challah. Who doesn't want to make that? Molly just finished filming the second season of her show, Girl Meets Farm, for the Food Network, and we just learned that the new season will start airing Sunday, November 11th. Mark your calendars. After we chat with Molly, we'll be talking to Carolyn Allen, who is the granddaughter of the founder of Contadina, the famous line of tomato products. Today, we're announcing our very first Cherry Bomb 100, our list of 100 women who inspire us every day through their creativity, their energy, their humanity, and their hard work. Contadina has graciously supported this project, so we're thrilled to talk to Carolyn later in the show. She's a retired restaurateur and shed some light on what it was like to be a woman in the industry in the 70s and the 80s. Be sure to check out cherrybomb.com today to see who is on our list. I hope you enjoy our conversations as much as I did. We'll be right back with Molly after this word from Le Cordon Bleu. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and patisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best food cities out there: London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin. Molly A., good to see you.
So good to see you, Carrie.
I have been so looking forward to this. It was a crazy weekend, and I was like, Monday, we got Molly A. It's going to be a good day.
I like weirdly kind of like Mondays. I don't know why.
You do?
Yeah. I think a lot of it is because I don't have a lot of pressure to cook meat because meatless Mondays. So I'm like, oh, I can make eggs for dinner, and then it's a thing.
Exactly. I think for me, Mondays go back to when you were a little kid and like nothing was worse than a Sunday night.
Sunday nights were the worst. Those were the days where I spent writing all my papers for school because I would just put it off to the end of the weekend, write papers. And I think maybe now because I don't have to do that and because I can kind of like take my time on a Monday morning and just kind of attack it the way I want to attack it, maybe I feel better about that. Because I'm still recovering from those terrible high school Sunday nights and high school Mondays.
Maybe just everybody procrastinates in high school. But you were your own boss for a long time. So any procrastination was your own problem, right?
Yeah, but I also could do things like allow myself to sleep in if I wanted to and just allow myself to work later into the night when I needed to. And that took a lot of pressure off of things. So,
but now Girl Meets Farm. You have.
Now I have to wake up.
Yes, you have to wake up. And you've got a lot. I guess you've got big cast and crew and a lot of people to report to.
Yeah. And it's like so much fun. It's kind of like being at summer camp because there are people just everywhere at all times of day while you're eating breakfast, while you're getting dressed, like while you're, you know, having your makeup and hair done. And it's just there's always somebody to chat with and hang out with. And I don't have that when I'm doing the blog. It's just me. At the most, it might be my photographer or I have some other people help out in the kitchen. But I would say most of the time when I'm doing my blog, it's just me and Netflix on in the corner of the kitchen.
I'm so behind on my Netflixing. I'm still, is that a word? Netflixing? Yeah. The only thing I've really managed to watch in a timely fashion was the Christina Tosi documentary, The Chef's Table.
Oh, so good.
Which was so good. People told me they cried when they watched it.
How could you not? The beautiful sprinkle porn. No, that was so good. I love her. I'm meeting her for the first time tonight.
You are?
And I am going to lose my shit.
We love her so much.
I love her, yeah.
She's amazing. What's tonight?
Tonight, I'm speaking about what is next in food.
What is next in food?
Okay. I feel as if this trend of making comfort foods and foods that we crave out of healthier ingredients like cauliflower pizza crust or butternut squash queso, aquafaba, the Impossible Burger, I feel like we've only hit the tip of the iceberg with what we can do with that. Because here's the thing, it's good. Like cauliflower pizza crust, and the way that I feel like it's going to stick around is because it's actually made its way to Grand Forks, North Dakota. I bought it from the freezer section of my local grocery store the other day, and it's actually really good. I feel good eating it, and I think that in the future, I mean, the Impossible Burger, I'm hoping is going to come to Grand Forks.
Have you tried it yet?
No.
I had it at Tracy Desjardins'
and it's good?
Restaurant in San Francisco. It was interesting. I mean, You know, I'm of two minds about those burgers. It's if you decide to be a vegetarian or eat better, I feel like you could have something else. But if you, you know, if you really do want a meat substitute in your life, it's a great option.
I mean, is it healthy on its own, or is it just kind of people think that because it's not meat?
Yeah, I don't have the answer to that. But I was at her restaurant with my friends and we ordered two of them, and I would never in a million years have been able to tell you it wasn't actually meat.
Wow.
Yeah.
That I think that there are so many possibilities there as far as making a ground beef substitute that people can cook with at home and doing other meat products. I think bacon is next for what's going to be actually tastily vegetarianified. I mean, now that we have kind of started off on this path of making healthier and vegetarian and, you know, just inserting like beans and vegetables into places where 20 years ago we only had tofu to make vegetarian versions of these things and they were gross. And I think that there are so many delicious options now for just accommodating every different dietary restriction and just, you know, getting more vegetables into our bodies, which is a good thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Have you made that coconut bacon yet?
I have, and it's good, but it's not bacon. It's really tasty, and I love it on a squash soup.
Coconut bacon is not bacon.
No, it's not bacon. It's a really tasty smoky topping to, you know, a squash dish or a root vegetable dish, and it's good. But
waiting for the bacon version of the Impossible Burger.
I'm waiting for the crispy on the outside, chewy on the inside, greasy slat of insert vegetable here.
You are about to start season two of Girl Meets Farm, which is,
oh my gosh,
so crazy. So you signed for just one season, so you didn't even know if there would be a second season? How does this all work in TV land?
I had this impending sense of doom after the first season where I just thought, okay, I guess it was just going to be that season. Because I don't know how this works, but the season happens and then eventually you just find out whether it has been picked up for a second season or not picked up for a second season. And I just every single day thought, okay, well, I'm not hearing about this. I'm not going to see my production friends anymore. That was what I was like really upset about, was because I really bonded with the production team and I missed them and I wanted them to come back and see the farm in the fall during harvest. But then it did get picked up. So now they're coming back and they get to see the beet harvest, which is happening. It started last night. So they get to see what I think is the most beautiful time of year on the farm, and all the leaves are changing. So, and also there are just like a lot of recipes that we didn't get to in the first season that I really wanted to make. Like my favorite food in the world is macaroni and cheese. And I make it all the time. And I have a million different recipes that I love making for it. And so that was the first thing that went onto our recipe grid for the second season. There are so many foods that I'm just really excited to eat during the
taping. I'm very excited for your macaroni and cheese. Mac and cheese is and has always been my favorite. So I'm really curious how the process works. So it's, even though you have like X number of episodes, do they just show up and film everything at once? Is that how it works?
Each day, I believe we do about an episode per day and a half. Each episode is built around an event. Mm-hmm. And that could be as casual as just having, you know, my sister-in-law over for lunch, or as, you know, exciting as a Thanksgiving meal. And we're doing a Chinese New Year episode. And like every episode is just a menu, like a cohesive menu. So typically we'll start with an idea for a main course. Although I think most of them started with ideas for desserts, just because that's where my head was at. And then we'll fill it in with sides and breads and different things to fill out the menu. And each recipe I cook twice. The first time
Twice,
and then we'll do
various... Well, you know what you're doing. They're your recipes.
Well, we'll also do various pickups, maybe close-ups of hands grabbing a lemon or close-ups of hands sprinkling salt, things like that. And the first time going through the recipe, the goal is to say all the things I want to say, get all the tips in, talk through the recipe, and then the second time filming it, I have to do different choreography moves, like sprinkle the salt a little bit slower so that can get in focus, or, you know, move my hands from the cutting board over to the pot at this speed so that everything can be caught on camera. And so it's a slightly different pace for that second run through the recipe.
And is there a director?
Yeah, so there's a director and a showrunner. And
oh, you have a showrunner.
Yeah.
Sounds so big time.
I'm still learning what that word means. But I kind of, I know now who to ask if I have a question about a certain shot, like a camera angle, or if I have a question about what to say about this type of recipe, or if I have a question about the recipe itself, there's a culinary producer. And so it's just like we're all hanging out in the kitchen and cooking.
So what have you learned either about yourself or it's kind of acting?
It's
right?
Hard. Oh my gosh. I mean, talking is the hardest thing. It's always been the hardest thing. And especially having a background of just sitting in a room on a computer writing about food and then transitioning to now not just cooking, but also talking, making eye contact with a camera, walking back to the refrigerator, walking over to the spice cabinet. It's just, it's a lot of coordination. And it brings me back to my days where I tried to play the drum set and I couldn't. So now I'm just forcing through this kind of learning phase of figuring out where my hands go and figuring out how not to chop a finger off as I'm giving a tip about salting.
So what will you be doing differently in season two, just like for yourself, things that you're like, I'm never doing that again?
I can't say the word just anymore.
You say the word just a lot?
I say the word just a lot. I think I've gotten a little better at cutting down on my likes. Like the word bit, like just, I'm just going to add a bit of this, a bit of that. I'm just going to add it. I'm not going to add bits of things anymore.
That happened with the radio show too. I would say wow all the time. It was like the only word I knew in my vocabulary was wow. Yeah. So let's talk more about food because that's how we all fell in love with you. And I was telling your peeps earlier that we have just adored you forever, which you know, back to our Yahoo Food days and then all the Cherry Bomb stuff. And you've been such a great member of the Bomb Squad. Tell me what you're obsessed with these days, food-wise.
You know what I'm obsessed with food-wise these days is going back to the basics and searching out recipes that are deceptively easy and deceptively delicious, like recipes where 1 + 1 = 5. Like the Melissa Clark salt and pepper chicken recipe. I just made that for the first time a few weeks ago, and since I have made it many more times, it's just amazing. And something about when you just do the correct things to a chicken, it's good.
What's in the recipe? A salt and pepper, obviously. Chicken.
That's it.
Really?
That's it. You have to let it dry out for a little bit.
I've heard that's a
big
secret.
In the refrigerator. Yeah. And
no cover. You let it just sort of...
No cover. Mm-hmm. You let it dry, and that helps the skin get nice and crispy. You add enough salt, which is huge. It's like... I have the recipe memorized already. It's 2.5 teaspoons of salt, kosher salt, a ton of black pepper. You pat it all over. You let the chicken
no
sit.
No oil, no nothing first?
No.
No butter?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
You mm-hmm. let the chicken sit in the fridge for an hour up to a day, and then you roast it at 450 for 50 minutes. You baste it 10 to 15 more minutes, and it's perfect. And I like stuffing some herbs into the cavity because we have so many herbs from our garden right now, but it doesn't necessarily need it. And it's so juicy and tasty and the skin is crispy. And I just feel like a magician when I make that recipe. And so it's things like that where they're delicious, good recipes and they just make ingredients better that I want to assemble an arsenal of these very simple, stupidly easy, yet amazing recipes. And not feel like I have to do complicated things.
That's a great idea. I mean, people still are so time pressed.
Yes.
I mean, it's fun to be in this world and read all these recipes and collect all these cookbooks. But the reality is, you know, so many nights a week, I'm like, ugh. I feel like if you don't do meal prep on Sundays or any kind of prep, you're done. Yeah.
And I think that people are starting to go easier on themselves. There was such a great article in Taste Cooking by J.J. Good.
Oh, love him.
Yes.
He's been on the show, one of the few guys.
He's so great. And it was an article about the difference that he has these two cooks in the kitchen. There's one that wants to do the extravagant multi-course meal, and then there's the one who has a kid yelling at him not to get any onions in the red sauce. And Deb had an amazing New York Times opinion piece about It was so cute. It was like all the reasons that she doesn't want to cook, but then all the reasons that she does.
Oh, I missed that. I have to
find
that.
It was about a month ago.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
It was so good. And I just feel like people are getting better at giving themselves breaks. I think that we're kind of recovering from this era of too muchery, of trying to do so much in the kitchen and doing all these complicated recipes and getting the sous vide machine out and doing all these things, that we're now kind of enjoying recipes that are simple and comforting and good. And yes, they're easier to make. I mean, everybody's coming out with an everyday book. There's Oda Lange's Simple. There's Deb's latest book is Everyday Food. And I think that I think we're going to see more of that. I'm hoping we're going to see more of that, because that's what we all need.
And tell us, you're pretty famous for your cakes. Tell us what's going on in the cake world. What do you see out there?
I just made a basbousa for the first time, which is a semolina-based cake. And it's not too sweet, and it gets a syrup poured over it right when it comes out of the oven. And sometimes there's a little rose water in it, and it's denser. But again, it's not too sweet. And so that, paired with all of the cakes that I'm seeing in California, like at Squirrel and at Lodge Bread Company, that are not too sweet and that also use a lot of whole grain flours and a lot of different flours, I think that that's where we go from here.
I also think all the alternative flours and grains that everybody's using right now is really just so interesting.
It's interesting, and at one point, a lot of these alternative flours were kind of just seen as, oh, this is a gluten-free alternative. As such, it might not be as good. But I read in Alana Taylor Tobin's book about alternative flours, she described it as it was like painting with all the different colors of the rainbow and an expanded palette, and you get so many different flavors and textures than you would get with just all-purpose flour. And she developed all the recipes in this book and then tasted a cake that was made with all-purpose flour, and it just tasted bland. It fell flat, and she hated it. And so just reading the introduction to her book converted me to want to explore this world of flours.
Absolutely. You know, I think of baking when I was a kid, it really was all just white flour, white sugar, butter.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know anybody who baked with coconut oil.
Yeah.
Or any alternative flours.
Uh-huh.
So it's just really exciting to see just how much is open. And you mentioned aquafaba. You know, I did a project recently with Lonnie Holiday. Have you met her yet?
No.
From Brutus Bake Shop.
Oh, cool.
She's so cool. She made these cookies, and they were vegan and free of lots of things that people have allergies to. And she used aquafaba. And it was like one of the tastiest cookies I'd had in ages.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love how people are like pushing the boundaries.
I love that new ingredients are being invented. It's really freaking cool that in this day and age, we have access to ingredients from all over the world, and we can Amazon Prime anything. And in my little farm in the middle of nowhere, I can have za'atar and sumac. But at the same time, it's not just finding ingredients from around the world. It's creating new ingredients, and it's seeing these innovators make these completely new things out of a wasted object or out of, I don't know, thin air.
But you've been the queen of that for a long time. I think that's another one of the reasons we all fell in love with you. You were doing these like crazy cultural mashups and everyone's like, what is going on out there on that farm?
I mean, I think I just, because I have a pantry that is made out of ingredients from everywhere, I don't see the need to keep the Middle Eastern ingredients with the Middle Eastern ingredients and the Chinese ingredients with the Chinese ingredients. I just have never seen or felt the need to see a huge divide when creating new dishes, because, I mean, for so many years, if you lived in China, you had access to Chinese ingredients. And if you lived in Minnesota, you had access to potatoes. And now you have access to all these things. So, you know, why shouldn't you just see what new flavors would be good together?
What are some of your most popular mashups? What do people still love telling
you that they've tried? The scallion pancake challah is something that I still like making all the time. And on Instagram, I'm tagged in photos of that all the time. And it's just, I mean, it's so good and comforting.
Walk us through the recipe.
Well, you make a very basic challah dough, which a good challah dough has a lot of oil and a lot of sugar And then you get the toppings that you would typically, or the fillings that you would typically put in a scallion pancake. So toasted sesame oil, chopped scallions. I do salt and pepper. Some people do white pepper. Crushed red pepper is really nice in that too. And instead of making logs to braid into the challah, you roll them out flat. So they're just kind of long, skinny rectangles. You brush them with the sesame oil, sprinkle them with scallions, salt and pepper, crushed red, and then roll those up like a very long, skinny jelly roll. Pinch them to seal and braid it. Brush it with egg wash, sprinkle it with stuff on top, and bake till golden.
I want that right now. What else are you tagged on all the time?
Funfetti.
Oh, you know what? As soon as that came out of my mouth, I was like, I know it. Funfetti. Yeah. You did a cute thing on the Food Network website that has all your sprinkles. And you collect sprinkles from around the world?
Yes. They're the best souvenirs.
That is the best idea ever because they won't confiscate them.
They won't confiscate them. They are lightweight. And you can get them at any everyday grocery store. So, you know, you go to France and you just go to the corner store or whatever the locals are shopping at, and their generic brand is, they're going to be different shapes, a different color palette, really cute, and they come in a small bottle, so you can, and they last forever.
That is so brilliant. When I saw that, I was like, oh my God, Molly, so smart. But it's such a cool way to see it. In a funny way, like sprinkles will tell you a lot about a country.
And that's what little kids growing up in France have on their birthday. And little kids in Israel, I mean, I have them from all over. And they're probably, a lot of them are stale by now because I like to save them and savor them. But yeah, I recently had to move my sprinkle collection because it was outgrowing its shelf.
And I love that people give you custom sprinkle mixes.
Yeah, like they're sprinkle mixologists and they will send me these sprinkle mixes. And there is a new company in, I want to say, Texas called Hardcore Sprinkles. Makes flavored sprinkles. There's a rose water sprinkle. I think there's a chocolate chili sprinkle. There might be a cinnamon sprinkle. And they're all different colors. And I think they're hand pipes. They look like they're hand pipe. And I mean, I think that's the future of sprinkles, is adding flavors and making them actually like seasonings or like a duca or something like that. Because, you know, why should this beautiful thing not have flavors? It should enhance the flavor too, as well as enhancing the visual effect. So sprinkle innovation is something we should talk about maybe at another time.
Gotta get NASA. Get NASA on that. Sprinkle innovation. The Department of Sprinkle Innovation. I like that. You can lead that department.
Okay.
But yeah, when you think about it, what does a sprinkle taste like? A sprinkle tastes like nothing.
Exactly.
But a sprinkle brings so much joy.
There's another company, Tysings, that is making sprinkles out of real white chocolate. Those are really tasty.
Flavored?
They're not different flavors. It's just white chocolate, and then the chocolate ones are okay. Real dark chocolate.
I love white chocolate and get a lot of SHIT for it.
What?
I know. People, like chocolate snobs, they just can't accept that white chocolate is a thing. They don't even think it should be called chocolate.
Have they accepted that milk chocolate is actually good?
Probably have issue with that too.
That's a recent innovation that I'm really grateful for. All of these articles saying that we need to be paying more attention to milk chocolate because it's actually tasty. And so the first time I saw one of those articles, I realized, yes, I've been lying to myself this whole time. I actually like milk chocolate. And it's so good. I mean, it's dark chocolate is a great ingredient in things, but I think as a standalone treat, milk chocolate is tastier.
Maybe we've just convinced ourselves because of all the talk about dark chocolate being good for you, but I do like a little square as a snack. Have I fooled myself into thinking I really like that?
No, it's good. I'm not saying dark chocolate is bad. No, it's
but you'd good. Rather snack on milk chocolate.
Yeah.
So Minneapolis, you and I chatted earlier and just about our affection for Minneapolis. And we went there on our book tour and had such a good time. Everybody was so nice. I couldn't believe it. We did our event at the Lynn Hall, which I know you love.
Great, yes.
An amazing place to stop by and have a meal, get some baked goods, just hang out. And then we went to Jamie Malone's Grand Cafe, which blew my mind. And I just thought it was really the kind of restaurant you wish you had in your neighborhood, that you would go, you know, once a week and definitely for all your special events. I just thought she is killing it there. Mm-hmm. And then I told you we went to the Gist Fermentation Bar, which blew my mind.
I need to go to.
And it's two sisters. One of them came to the event and said, oh, hey, I have a fermentation bar. And I'm like, oh, my God, what is a fermentation bar? And I said, I don't know you, and I don't know your fermentation bar, but I'm going to be there tomorrow night without fail. And I was. And we had kimchi shots, and we had beet pickled eggs, and they had this like miso caramel popcorn. We had that. And then you could also get kombucha. I think we had kombucha. Yeah, sounds right.
Your digestive system must have been A plus that week.
But I was like, how do we not have this in Brooklyn?
There are so many great places in Minnesota. I love it. I mean, I think the community there is very encouraging of people pursuing their passions. And not to say that other communities aren't, but I think that, I don't know what it is. I mean, people are so nice there. I find it frustrating because when I make something that I think sucks and I serve it to my friends, none of them are going to tell me. But everybody is so supportive.
Everyone was so nice.
The community is amazing.
Did I tell you Sarah Kiefer brought me her those pan-banging cookies that she made herself?
Those are so good.
Which were so, I mean, I shared them with the people in the hotel, but I really just wanted to keep them all to myself and bring them back.
Her baking book I keep by my side at all times when I'm at home because
And that's
everything
the vanilla bean baking book,
the
right?
Vanilla
is that
bean
the title?
Baking book. I just made about a million brownies for a wedding from her book, and I didn't think any of them were going to make it to the wedding because they were so good. And it's just like everything in there is just solid and delicious.
So these are the cookies, and I'm sure everyone's heard of these. You, in the middle of cooking them, kind of pick up the pan and drop it, which sounds really terrifying.
And it creates ripples
right
in the cookies. And they're just fun to eat, and
they were
fun
so
to make,
good.
And they're chewy, and they're good.
They were everything I love, in a
her.
Chocolate chip cookie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Minneapolis, I feel like one thing I like about Minneapolis is that...
Oh, I was going to say, if Sarah Kiefer's listening to this...
Hi, Sarah.
Sarah, come to Brooklyn.
Come to Brooklyn.
I'll come to Grand
come
Forks.
Hang out.
I'll buy all the ingredients.
She's hard at work on her new cookie book. She's doing a whole book on cookies, which is going to be awesome.
Smart. Smart cookie.
But I don't know like how Minneapolis is so great, but it is. And I think here's one reason. I like that they're not trying to be anybody else. They have this really cool Nordic influence. A lot of people in Minnesota are descendants of Scandinavians, and they embrace the cold and they embrace the coziness. There is this whole initiative to keep the North cold. There are these hats that say North on them because there's also this initiative to make Minnesota and North Dakota and South Dakota its own region, the North. And I love that because there is such a strong culture there. They are a big city, but they're not trying to be New York. They're not trying to be LA. They're just trying to develop their own identity. They are developing their own identity, and a lot of it is inspired by Scandinavian cultures and because of how cold it is. And like people there love the cold. There's sauna culture. People have mobile saunas in their backyards, which is so cool.
Do you have a mobile sauna in your
I
backyard?
I will. That's my 10-year plan. But it's
can't people, the producers of Girl Meets Farm buy you a mobile sauna?
We'll do
That's a great sauna episode. Yes, 100%.
Because I think there are actually recipes where you can put them in the sauna and they cook while you're in the sauna. I don't know if that's real or if I just made that up.
I bet the health department would love that. Naked bodies. Food.
But surely you have to eat after you've been in the
you
sauna
You cook
for
as
a
the
while.
Food cooks. It's
yeah.
great. Yeah. That's so funny. I did not know about the movement to have that region called the North.
Yes, because if you think about it, the Midwest also includes Ohio and St. Louis and Kansas, and those places are all great, but they are drastically different. I mean, I grew up in Chicago, which is technically the same region as where I'm living now, but it's so different than the culture that I live in now, which is... I mean, there are so many different foods that I didn't even know about when I lived there.
Like?
Or that I didn't even know about until I lived there, like hot dish. There's a soup called Nefla soup. Nefla are small
German dumplings that are chewy. The best ones have a little bit of nutmeg in them, and you put them into this potato soup that is everything you could ever want when it's raining outside or snowing outside and it's cold. And it's so good. It blows my mind. I was actually sitting on the couch the other day looking at the Nefla hashtag.
How does one spell Nefla if they want to look up the Nefla hashtag?
K-N-O-E-P-H-L-A. And they're these little square dumplings. And usually they get put into this potato soup. Sometimes they get pan-fried with some sauerkraut and sausage. But I tasted it for the first time when I moved to Grand Forks, and still on the hashtag, all of the posts are from North Dakota, and it blows my mind that it has not worked its way out of the region because it is so good.
Do you have a recipe on your website? Is there an ultimate
recipe? I have one in
recipe?
My book.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll find it.
I have one in my book, but add some dill to it.
Okay.
Add fresh dill when you're making the soup.
All right. As soon as it gets a little cold, I'm going to make that.
So good.
And I'll tag you. Last question. You've been a busy lady for the past few years. How are you taking care of yourself these days? Are you taking care of yourself?
I love to sleep in. And I love a good salami sandwich.
That is your recipe for self-care.
Yep.
Sleep and salami. At least you have a self-care practice.
Oh, I'm good at self-care. I kind of get confused when there are all these initiatives to promote self-care to people because I'm really good at it, which I think in some terms could be called lazy, but I really appreciate my couch time and my sleeping in.
Well, Molly, you know how much we love you. I love you guys. You are the bomb, and you've been the bomb for a long time.
Thank you.
So we honestly, we were just so excited when we found out about Girl Meets Farm.
Thank you.
We were thrilled. Thanks for stopping by, Molly.
Thanks so much, Carrie.
We're going to take a short break. Then we'll be right back after this word from our sponsor, Vital Farms. Does this happen to you? You need a dozen eggs. You go to the supermarket. You head to the egg section. And you are so confused by what you find there, you freeze. You want nice eggs on hand because maybe you want a cheese and herb omelet for dinner, or you want to poach an egg to slip on your avocado toast, and you know quality eggs make a big difference. And you're a decent person, so it's important that chickens have a good life. But as you stand there, you think to yourself, I have no idea what all these words on the egg cartons mean. So you shrug, pick one, and continue shopping. Stop right there. You are a busy lady. You don't need this bull in your life. You need bull free eggs, which is where Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs come in. Their pasture-raised hens roam outside in 108 square feet of space per hen. Those cage-free hens, they never go outside. I tasted the difference once I tried Vital Farms eggs. Try for yourself. To get your coupon for Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs, head to vitalfarms.com/cherrybomb. Our next guest is Carolyn Allen. She is the granddaughter of the founder of Contadina, the legendary line of tomato products. As I mentioned earlier, Contadina is supporting our very first Cherry Bomb 100 list, which is live today on cherrybomb.com. So we thought it would be fun to talk to Carolyn about her family and her career as a restaurateur in the early days of Silicon Valley. Enjoy our conversation. So I thought we could start with your family's connection to Contadina. So your grandfather was actually the founder?
So my grandfather and two of his brothers, as well as a brother-in-law, were the founders of Contadina. You know, that was, wow, 100 years ago. They actually started off in the business a little bit before that, but they didn't trademark and actually launch the brand until 1918.
Can you believe it's been 100 years?
I can't. time flies very quickly. Even though my family sold their business interest in Contadina back in the early 1930s, it's been a constant in our lives.
So what do you remember about the brand as a little girl?
Oh, well, as I said, you know, Contadina was kind of a constant in our lives. Of course, it was always used as the tomatoes and tomato paste of choice. And always hearing stories about the family and how it started, and, you know, when my grandparents came to this country and how they started out and how they decided to, you know, to get into the tomato canning business. So most of it was just passed down history. Of course, you know, whenever we would celebrate holidays, you know, Contadina was involved because we always cooked with it.
Where did your grandfather and his brothers come from?
So my family, the Aiellos, came from a little town called Bagheria in Sicily, and it's just outside Palermo. They all came within about a 5-year period of time. I would say 1898 through about 1903, 1904, they all arrived and ended up in New York City. My grandfather, Carlo, and his oldest brother, Francesco, both opened bakeries in New York City. My grandfather's bakery was on 2nd Avenue up in the Upper East Side. My great uncle Francesco had a bakery in Little Italy, and both of them were very successful. My grandfather, besides Panetteria Italiana, he also imported into Italian products. And some of the products that he imported were canned tomatoes and paste, because there were no tomato factories in the United States at that time.
That's crazy to think about. I mean, they're so popular today. I mean, I can't imagine life without tomatoes.
Right. Those goods were imported, and their idea was to can tomatoes here because they couldn't get them anymore. And there was a huge Italian population by that time, you know, would use the canned tomato products.
Do you know why they picked the name Contadina?
It was actually my great aunt Francesca, who was married to Francesco. The feeling was that, you know, they wanted to appeal to the Italian women that had come to the United States and had in many cases come from impoverished rural areas of Italy. And the contadina is, you know, a country woman, a woman who works in the fields. So they wanted to give them a piece, I think, of Italy. Here wanted them to feel that connection to their homeland. So that's why they chose the name.
So where did you grow up?
So I grew up in San Jose, California, born and raised. That's, you know, it's in the middle of Santa Clara Valley. It's now called Silicon Valley. But at the time when I was born in the 1950s, of course, it was still primarily agricultural. And so it was really a center for, you know, growers and canners. And I watched the transition over the years, over 2-3 decades, from an agricultural center to a high-tech center. But it was a beautiful place to grow up, very bucolic.
I can imagine. Who did the cooking in your house?
So both my parents enjoyed cooking. My mother is not Italian. She was actually Portuguese and French, but she was a really wonderful baker. But my father did most of the cooking in the family.
Really? And, that's unusual. Yeah.
Again, he had learned from his parents. Both of my grandparents were fantastic cooks. You know, my grandmother's family was also from Sicily. They were from a little town called Castelvaccio. And her family had a beautiful citrus orchard, and they didn't sell the produce. What they did is they candied it. So they were confectioners. And so she was really a very talented cook, and especially baker and pastry maker. So he had an interest early on. My father had an interest early on.
Did your family call it sauce or gravy?
We called it sauce.
Sauce. Okay, yeah. I come from a sauce family too. So your dad had this restaurant, and you eventually took over the restaurant.
I did, yeah. It wasn't intentional. I wanted to be a journalist. Actually, I was kind of a professional student. I went to college and moved around in college. I mean, I went to, I think 3 or 4 different colleges and kept changing my major. Eventually decided to move to San Francisco, change my major to journalism. And then my mom passed away when I was 23 years old. And I had a brother who was only 14. So I decided to move home and help my dad out for a few years. Just never left. Something about the restaurant business gets in your blood, I think.
And plus the fact that it was your family restaurant, you know, you don't want to see that go away. But to be a woman running and owning a restaurant back in the 70s and the 80s, I mean, it wasn't uncommon, but it wasn't also super common. How did you find the experience?
It was very difficult in the beginning. I mean, I was a young woman, you know, in my early 20s. I didn't have any culinary experience. I had, you know, been passionate about cooking like everyone else in my family and loved to take part in preparing holiday meals and that type of thing. And always in college, loved to cook for my friends, but never intended to go in the restaurant business. And so walking in kind of cold turkey, it was difficult. And, you know, it was primarily a man's world, both front of the house and back of the house, other than, you know, occasionally a waitress or something like that in the front of the house. But yeah, it was very difficult. It was very intimidating. And it took me some time to get my footing and feel comfortable. But, you know, that was also, I think, in the 70s, you know, I started hearing about Alice Waters and, you know, some of the people that I admired were Madeline Kahn and, you know, others that were more cookbook authors and teachers. Just seeing them and hearing about them and reading about them gave me encouragement that I could, you know, I could do this.
So, you know, we're doing this Cherry Bomb 100 list that we put together of some of the most inspiring women in the food world today. And a lot of them are from California. I mean, I think a lot of, pun not intended, seeds were sown back in those days when you were running Paolo's and when Alice, you know, started Chez Panisse. It's interesting. We started Cherry Bomb because we were looking for more community in the food world and to give women more recognition in the food media. And California, though, was just so far ahead of the rest of the country in terms of women running restaurants, women starting food companies, female chefs. So it's really remarkable. I feel like California was just so far ahead of the curve in many respects, not just in terms of the cuisine that, you know, everybody grew to know as California cuisine, but in terms of women's role in the food world.
Yeah, I think California has been a home to pioneers in many industries, and I think it's natural that it would also be that way in the culinary industry as well. Excited that that Cherry Bomb has chosen to, you know, announce their Cherry Bomb 100, the Contadina 100 year celebration of the brand. So that's great.
No, we're really excited. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think back to like what you were saying, you know, you felt kind of alone in what you were doing and learning how to run a restaurant as a very young woman, but you knew about these other women who are out there. I think it's kind of the same with the list. You know, it's so hard running. It's still hard. You know, I mean, you were doing Paolo's in the 70s and the 80s, but,
right,
you know, fast forward to 2018, it's still really hard to be a woman, yeah, running a place or running your own company. And I do hope that other women who are out there who maybe don't know other people in the industry or who are just trying and working really hard will see that list and get strength from it and just know that there are incredible people out there trying to do good things just like they are.
Absolutely. Growing the community and making people, you know, making women especially feel like they are part of a group that can encourage each other and support each other and lift each other up is wonderful. And it's definitely time for it.
Absolutely. You're not alone out there, ladies. So here's the million-dollar question, or maybe a billion-dollar question. Why is everybody so crazy for Italian food? People love Italian food.
I think it's comfort food. You know, it's especially good on cold winter nights to have a beautiful plate of pasta. I mean, it doesn't get better than that. Italian food is really all about the freshest ingredients. So no matter what season you're in, if you take the best of what there is in that season and prepare it simply, you know, it's going to be delicious.
Pretty much any day of the week, I would be very happy with a bowl of pasta. What Contadina products are in your pantry right now?
I like using the whole tomatoes and the tomato paste. Those, and I also use the sauce occasionally, usually to add to some other dish. I don't use it as a straight sauce, but it's great as a base for other things. But definitely whole tomatoes and the tomato paste. I love the paste.
Tell me what you do with the whole tomatoes. Give the listeners a little tip.
The thing that I enjoy doing the most with them, just, you know, because of my background, is just making a good old fashioned, you know, tomato sauce, pomodoro sauce. So I like starting with the whole tomatoes and crushing them in my hands. Ooh. And then using it that way as opposed to, you know, buying them, you know, already diced or processed in another way. I like that tactile feel of crushing the tomatoes myself and not having a real smooth sauce. It's, I don't know, I just like that a little bit slightly chunkier style.
I love that tip of using your hands, because I'll cut the canned whole tomatoes on a cutting board, and now I realize, and it's always so messy, but now I realize, like, if you do it with your hands, it not only is it like really engaging in terms of the senses, but it's a lot less messy.
It is.
I never thought about that. You do have to wash your hands, but
and also you lose all the juice.
Right, so, right.
You know, I always like to either crush them slowly with my, I take them out like one at a time out of the can, and then hang them over the pot, and then crush them with my hands that way. And they're going to break down a little bit anyways as you cook them. You know, they'll break down a little bit more. But I just like that feel of doing it that way. And I like to have a sauce that's not pureed, that's a little bit chunkier.
And it is so nice to engage the senses when you're cooking.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I think that's, people sometimes forget, like, it's not just taste and the sense of taste. It's touch and smell and all of that.
Exactly. You got to get your hands into it.
Well, Carolyn, thank you so much for your time. We really, really appreciate it. What a wonderful thing to be part of this brand that's meant so many things to so many people over the years, including my family. My mom and grandmother used Contadina, and my mom taught me how to make sauce, and she always used Contadina. So it's been in my family for a long time as well.
I'm very, very excited that the brand has endured and flourished in the last 100 years, and, you know, that it's really, I think, an iconic brand now. It's all about the family and the family roots in Italy, and it's, you know, it's still a piece of the old country to me. So,
well, as we'd like to tell all our favorite people here at Cherry Bomb, you're the bomb, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Take care.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to Carolyn Allen for taking the time to chat with us about her life and about Contadina. And thank you to Contadina for supporting the Cherry Bomb 100, live now on cherrybomb.com. It means a lot to me for multiple reasons, but one of the biggest ones is that my mom would always make tomato sauce and taught me how to make her tomato sauce, and she always used Contadina. And I actually asked my mother why she always used Contadina, and she said she learned about it from her grandmother. So my family has a lot of history with that brand, so it was very nice talking to someone else who has major history with that brand. So thank you to everyone involved. And a huge thank you again to Molly Yeh for taking time out of her busy schedule and stopping by and talking to us. Don't forget to watch her show Girl Meets Farm on the Food Network when the new season launches this November. And by the way, we recorded our interview with Molly at The Wing in Dumbo. To learn more about The Wing, go to the-wing.com. And thanks to The Wing folks for being so awesome. And thank you to our sponsors, Vital Farms Pasture-Raised Eggs and Le Cordon Bleu Culinary School. Thank you to our associate producer, Jess Zeidman. Jess, you're the bomb. And to the band Tra La La for our theme song. Don't forget Cherry Bomb University, taking place October 26th, 27th, and 28th in New York City. Visit cherrybomb.com for tickets and more information. I look forward to seeing all you smart cookies there. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.
Hello, I'm Cherry Bomb intern Audrey Payne. You know who I think is the bomb? Po Ling Yao. I've been baking my way through her newest cookbook, Po Bakes 100 Greats, and I am obsessed with her pecan double chocolate brownies. They're such a treat. I'm sure you'll love them too.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.